Before we begin lecture properly, particularly for the new students, let me show you how to get to the website for this course. So instead of giving you some kind of URL, I'll just show you how to get there, and then later today, once I've finished updating everything on the website, I'll email an announcement out that also has the link to it. But easiest way to get there is just to go to DeAnza's main website. So www.deanza.edu. When you go there, click on faculty and staff, and then on the right-hand side where it says quick links, if you look under there, you can find one that says not faculty staff directories, but faculty websites. Find my last name, Gray, G-R-A-Y. There is more than one Gray, although I don't think I look that much like a Joyce. So, hey, down in front. So, David Gray, click on that. That'll take you to the main website. You want the Chem 12B button, so click on that. That takes you to the Chem 12B webpage. You're Section 3, so you'll notice the note that says over here, this first page that you jump to is for Sections 1 and 2. That's because we didn't used to have three sections at OChem, and I got to redo my website because of that. So Section 3, you click where it says, click here, and then this will be your web page. The syllabus is not posted yet. I still need to fill in those few problem numbers, but I'll be posting it later today. The course outline is currently available. Most likely you're not going to need that, but when you transfer, most institutions, we have articulation agreements, which means we already have agreements in place of how Chem 12B from here transfers to somewhere else. But in case you have an institution that does not have one of these automatic agreements, or if they're fussy about the way that they do transfer, they may ask you for this course outline, which lists every single topic that no matter who teaches the course, the instructor is supposed to follow those topics. Down below here, I do have office hours already fixed for the quarter. So Mondays and Wednesdays will be right after the OChem class those days. Well, almost right after, quick break there so I could run get some food. So 2:25 to 3:15, Monday, Wednesdays. Tuesdays and Thursdays happen just like it did today. It'll be 10:30 to 11:20 between your lab time and your lecture time. On Fridays, I have another class's 10:30 lecture, then I have your 11:30 lecture, so I thought it made sense to put office hours before both of them, just in case we did have a quiz or something that falls on a Friday. Gives everybody a chance to come ask me questions. My office is in room 1214, which if you go out the main lab door here, go across past the ugly staircase towards the phone that's sitting there, dial in, you can get into my office. We have that phone there only because we have computers that are not in individual offices locked down, and we have had a problem with theft in the past, if not here, then other places on campus. Office extension, my phone number is 5608. All DeAnza phone numbers are 408-864 and then four digits, so my four digits are 5608. Email, Gray David, my last name, then first name, at deanza.edu. On the syllabus, you'll see I do have the Twitter account that I've mentioned where I'll be tweeting once I do post notes, so you don't have to keep checking the web page. Is it there yet? Is it there yet? Just look for the tweet update. Or there is the Facebook page, which Marvin, who's one of the tutors, he can approve you to be in that group, or I can also approve you to be in that group. Up at the top here, I haven't updated the assignments yet, although it does list the fact that you do have a pre-lab that's due, which, yes, I managed to get the correct date on there. It's due Thursday the 12th. The one thing I want to tell you that's not filled in here yet is your final exam. Your final exam is on... Oh dear, just had it. 1 second. Erased it. But I think it was at March 29th, the Thursday, at 11:30. I'll go back and I just had the page open. Must have closed it by habit when I got here. But if you go to the final exam schedule, this is a class that meets for lecture on Thursdays. And the way they assign the final exam time is whether you have a class that meets on Thursday or not. We do, and so that's why it's my recollection that we have it on Thursday. You know, I'm worried enough, let me just do that right now. So. So, final exam schedule. Our lecture meets at 11:30, so yes, it is 11:30 on March 29th. That is a time that's assigned by the campus, not by me. And I know that some of you might have other finals that day, but unless you have, I have to check the catalog, I think it's 4 finals on the same day, then only in that case is one of your instructors required to change your final exam time. If you're like most students that maybe have one other exam that day, unfortunately, that's just part of being a college student. So I can't make alternate final exam arrangements just because you have one other final exam. So I'm warning you this far ahead of time so you can plan your studying accordingly. Once you do get the syllabus, once it's posted later today, it has all the information as far as grades and such. I'll make some comments on Thursday once you all have had a chance to look over it, particularly those of you who are new. But otherwise, for today, I'd like to just jump straight into our first lecture, which our first lecture is coming from Chapter 10, a chapter on alcohols and ethers. Again, when you get the syllabus, the exact topic-by-topic breakdown, what we're doing on a day-by-day basis is going to be there, but Chapter 10 is where we're going to be for a little while to start the quarter off with. So, alcohols. I might have made this comment last quarter, I don't remember. When I was learning O-Chem, my O-Chem instructor had this story he told once that imagine you were on a desert island out in the middle of nowhere, except that somehow you had this fantastic chemical synthesis facility, except for the fact that you only had the 5 sources of carbon that you could use for anything that you might need to make to live out the rest of your life. So the instructor said, well, what would those 5 compounds be? Because you'd want something that'd be really useful, make anything out of. And his answer was, well, all 5 of them would be alcohols, the major one of which, if you're stuck on a desert island, would be ethanol, which, if you're not familiar, is the active ingredient in alcoholic beverages, yes. But why would he joke that 5 alcohols would be what you want to have for starting materials? Because if you were to draw an alcohol in the middle of a piece of paper, you're going to find that you, by the end of 12C at least, will know methods for converting that alcohol in 1 or 2 steps, for the most part, into every other functional group. And the reverse is true as well. Most other functional groups with a small number of steps can be converted into an alcohol. So in a larger synthesis, it's not uncommon for an alcohol to be one of the main synthetic intermediates. If not one of the main intermediates, then one of the primary reagents to generate other functional groups from. And that's, in fact, what we're going to start the quarter with, because we played a lot with alkyl halides last quarter. We learned about SN1, SN2, E1, and E2. So wouldn't it be great if we could take an alcohol and make it be usable in one of these substitution or elimination reactions? Because an alcohol itself doesn't have a good leaving group. So the first set of reactions we're going to see is to turn an alcohol into an alkyl chloride, an alkyl bromide, an alkyl iodide, and what's my other favorite type of leaving group that we learned last quarter? Sulfonates, like a tosylate. So we'll learn how to make tosylates as well. Before we do that even, though, I want to review the types of pieces of information that you want to put on flashcards. So the new students, hopefully you've already gotten in the habit of making flashcards. If you hadn't, well, then I'm going to describe what you might want to have on one of them. Returning students, if you did not get in the habit of flashcards last quarter, you want to this quarter, because you learned maybe 15 or 20 reactions last quarter, something like that. You're going to be doing that in about the first 2 weeks this quarter. So the pace of things is very different this quarter. Not to make you all groan the first day of class, but people do generally view 12B as the harder of the 3 quarters, because we're not doing the introductory theory, and you get all these wonderful new reactions that you have to learn. So the point of warning you is that if you weren't doing flashcards before, get on them right away. So let's go over those pieces of information that belong in a So how exactly you get this information on a card is kind of up to you, although generally what I recommend is, well, mechanism is going to be one of these things, and mechanism I usually put on one side of the card, and the other pieces of information I usually put on the other. So, first thing off is, what is the synthetic utility of a reaction? In other words, what does it make? So I already mentioned that one of the things we're going to do today is learn how to convert an alcohol into some form of alkyl halide. And there'll be different reactions that we do for alkyl chlorides, bromides, and iodides. So a synthetic utility might be to convert an alcohol to an alkyl chloride. Generally, for a particular type of reaction, there's some characteristic, unique set of reagents. So the second thing you need to know are, what are the particular reagents for a reaction? Along with that, there may be certain reaction conditions that might need to be obeyed. For example, hydroboration can't be done in the presence of water. It would totally kill off the borane. Grignard reaction that you're learning this quarter, same type of thing. Can't be done in the presence of water, or technically can't be done in the presence of water, oxygen, or carbon dioxide. They would all cause decomposition of the reagent involved. Some reactions have to be done with heat, some can't be done with heat. Some have to be done with light, some can't be done with light. So those are the types of things that you would put under conditions. The most important of these things that you need to know really is mechanism. Now, since we already did some problem review this morning, let me say that the first three of these items would be more the type of thing that you would encounter on a fill-in-the-blank problem. Then there is the type of problem where you just have mechanism, which means the full step-by-step mechanism for a reaction. There will occasionally be reactions that we don't see mechanism for, either because it's not known or it's too complicated for the level of this course. But we're going to generally use mechanism to be able to describe two other aspects of a reaction, which is what happens in terms of stereochemistry. And there's stereochemistry in a couple different forms. If you already have a stereocenter that the reaction ends up interacting or affecting, then maybe it'll be something like an SN2 reaction where you have inversion of configuration. Maybe it'll be something like an SN1 reaction where you have loss of configuration. Or maybe it'll be like what we see today where you end up with retention of configuration. That's one form of stereochemistry. Another form would be something like alkene reactions. Would it be a reaction like bromination, where the first bromine ends up making a ring on one face of the double bond, which therefore causes the second bromine to attack from the opposite face, and that's called antiaddition. Or maybe you'd have something like hydrogenation. We saw earlier today how you could take an alkyne and make a specifically cisalkene. That's a form of syn addition. So those are the types of stereochemical concerns that we might have. And again, many of those we can get from the mechanism of a reaction. Along with stereochemistry, then, is regiochemistry. Where does something end up? Sometimes there aren't regiochemical concerns. For example, when we learn reductions of ketones and aldehydes, that reduction always happens where the ketone is. Maybe it's something like addition to a double bond, where you have this Markovnikov addition principle, where the stability of the intermediate influences where the eventual attack is going to occur on that molecule. So those are the types of things that we worry about with regiochemistry. So in principle, every reaction we learn, you need to know all of these items for. But don't just go blindly memorizing these things. Because especially if you can remember a mechanism, you can use that mechanism to figure out stereochemistry and regiochemistry. And what you're going to see is there's a lot of commonality between mechanisms, particularly when we get to reactions of carbonyl. There's cationic mechanisms, there's anionic mechanisms, and many of them look almost like each other, are very, very similar. So it's better to learn the patterns. And last quarter, it might have been all memorization because everything was new. But you're going to see a lot of things that look just like pieces of mechanisms that we learned last quarter. So I'm just cautioning you, don't blindly memorize. look for patterns as you're trying to absorb all this material. So particularly for new students, any question about flashcards? And one last time, I will be going through this week, because I'll get yelled at online and in person if I don't, and make up a list of the reactions that we did last quarter, so everybody knows what you're responsible for just going into the quarter. But why don't we go ahead and start seeing some of these reactions of alcohols? Or just to, again, kind of warm us up for the quarter, why don't we revisit just briefly the nomenclature of alcohols? So we'll do just a few simple examples for today, since we did cover alcohol nomenclature last quarter. Part of the reason I want to review it, though, is that I remember there being a difficulty of what to do with the AN portion of a name. Like, if this didn't have an alcohol on it, this four-carbon compound would be called butane, with an A-N-E. There's sometimes when we make names where we play with the E ending, get rid of it and add something to it. There's sometimes where we change that ane ending. And we're going to see when you do what when we're trying to name alcohols. Now, an alcohol in general has what characteristic functional group ending to it? All. So all alcohols that have just alcohols in them are going to end with the syllable all. For most alcohols, we have to say where the alcohol is positioned, because this is a form of butanol, but this is a form of butanol as well. Now, how do we number a simple alcohol like this, where it's the only functional group on a molecule? Start whichever end is going to give the alcohol the lowest possible number. So for the first compound, would we start from the left or the right? For the first compound, would we start on the left or the right? The right, because the OH group is at the end on the right. So we'd number backwards, 1, 2, 3, 4. There are two ways to name this. The old style is to put the position number in front of the number of carbons. So in other words, it would be named 1-butanol. But for clarity's sake, there was a change at one point where the position number got moved to right before whatever substituent or functional group that number was trying to describe. And I greatly prefer the second style, because to me it is more systematic. However, since so many texts and chemicals are still labeled with the old style, if you use the old style naming, you won't get marked off for it as long as you're doing it correctly. If this is butane 1-ol, then next door, then yes, this is the one that we would number from the left, because from the left it would get the number 2 instead of the number 3. And so this would be either 2-butanol or butane 2-ol. Now, most of the time you need these position numbers, but there's three easy examples of cases where you wouldn't use numbers. And that's if it's not possible to have an alternate number. For example, ethanol. Whether you put the OH group on the left carbon or the right carbon, it automatically makes it carbon number 1, because it's only 2 carbons long. So because there's no ambiguity, that's why the number is not needed. Similarly, if we only had 1 carbon, then there's no need to number it. And another similar case is if you have a cyclic compound that only has 1 alcohol on it, 1 of the most important functional group on there. Then in that case also, since that would automatically be assigned the position 1, we can leave the 1 out. So it's just called cyclohexanol. So any questions on these simple monoalcohols? Then let's see a couple of slightly more complicated examples. Let's see what would happen if we did have 2 alcohols on a molecule. So this doesn't have any substituents, So this is a butane diol. So we put the prefix di in there to show there's two alcohols. And we do have to name where the alcohols are located. So would I number this compound from the left or from the right? Again, from the right. It does not matter overall how big the numbers are. It's the very first number you write down that needs to be as small as possible. So from the left, the first number we would get is 2. From the right, the first number we get is 1. 1 is lower than 2, and that's why we number from the right. So this is butane. If I'm doing it the new style, 1,3-diol. Notice that the ane ending is still there. When you're using all, the only thing it replaces is the E in the word. So you don't get rid of that ane because, in fact, the AN shows that it is saturated. One of the most minor spelling rules for naming compounds is when do you use an E and when do you not use an E? In this case, we use an E because there's consonants coming up. And then notice the di that's here, which is used because we have two alcohols on that molecule. There is one thing I've left out, though. What's that? Is it R or S? 2, 3, 4. R. Yes. Oh, yes, that's right. Marvin, you haven't seen... I now have toys I play with in class. So there's our most important functional group. There's automatically, this is the second most important functional group because it's got carbon attached to anything besides hydrogen versus this least important other than the hydrogen because there's only hydrogens attached to that position. So 1, 2, 3, it goes clockwise, so that is R. Since we only have the one stereocenter, you don't need to use numbers with it. So this complete name is R-butane-1,3-diol or R-1,3-butane-diol. You could put the 1,3 in front just like the other molecules. Last example for today is what if you do have an alkene with an alcohol? There is an order of priority, and what is it? What's more important, an alkene or an alcohol? It's an alcohol. So all the hydrocarbons are less important than alcohols, aldehydes, ketones, any of the functional groups we're learning this quarter. So that means it's going to be numbered, in this case, from the right to give the OH group the lower number instead of the alkene. There are no substituents, so we'd name the molecule just with its core name. And notice that it's a terminal alkene, so there's not even any cis-trans that we need to worry about. No stereocenters. So this is a 5-carbon compound, so it's pent. But it does have an alkene. This is where that AN part of the ending changes. It becomes EN to show that we do have unsaturation. At the one position, we then have an alcohol. We don't use an E after the N because there's already a vowel coming. So this is its full name, pent-4-ene-1-ol. This is why I prefer the newer style of naming because there's no confusion as to what the 4 refers to, what the 1 refers to. Yes? So if we had yet another alcohol, it would be pentene-diol. Then it'd be just like above, pentane-diol. The AN would still be there. Questions on nomenclature? Yes? I'll still accept the old style, correct? let's move on to some reactions now, since we've reviewed nomenclature. The first reaction I want to show you involves the molecule SOCl2, thionyl chloride, which has this structure to it. Notice the lone pair on sulfur. That's probably the most missed part of that molecule structure. That sulfur-oxygen bond has somewhat the reactivity like a carbon-oxygen bond, primarily due to the fact that it's polarized. Which of the two ends of that bond would you say is more negatively charged? Well, what's the most electronegative element in that compound? Oh, now we should know this without even looking at a periodic table. Fluorine's the most electronegative element. What's the second most electronegative? Oxygen. So oxygen's going to be negatively charged, partially negatively charged. That means the sulfur is going to be very positively charged, because aside from the sulfur-oxygen double bond, you have these two electronegative chlorines also pulling electron density away. So think about what the structure of an alcohol is. There are two main ways an alcohol will react. What do you guess one of them is? What about that hydrogen? Does anybody remember a rough pKa value for this alcohol? Anybody remember the pKa of water? 15.7. And in solution, alcohols have about the same acidity as water does. So primary alcohols have a pKa around about 16, which means that hydrogen can be pulled off comparatively easy, easier than a lot of just plain old hydrocarbons. So one form of reaction of alcohols that we'll see later is for that hydrogen to react. But if you think about polarity, the oxygen there is, again, partially negatively charged because it's the most electronegative element. So if we threw these two molecules, thionyl chloride and this alcohol, together, what could you imagine an opening first step might logically be? For the oxygen to attack the sulfur, for the negative, partially negatively charged atom to attack the partially positively charged atom. And that's exactly what happens. Now, we've got plenty of time to get into itty-bitty details. And what I'm leading up to eventually is there are multiple ways to write this mechanism. And we'll discuss later on why or why not to do some of these different ways I'm showing you. Keep things simple for today, give you a chance to go to the book and read before we get it too much into detail. I'm going to show you the mechanism in this way. Because if that oxygen attacks the sulfur, then something has to give. And it would make sense that that sulfur-oxygen bond might break, because that would look something like what might even happen during resonance. But once that bond opens, you end up with a negative charge sitting there, which is pretty basic. Well, if you have a negative charge in the oxygen, wouldn't it be simple if it were to just come back, reattack sulfur, and kick chlorine off at the same time? So this is a kind of wraparound mechanism. You might think, is this the way it really works? Well, there is some evidence for that sulfur-oxygen bond being kicked open, but just like there might be evidence to show chlorine being directly kicked off. Because this is the first day, because I want to focus on alcohols, I'm bringing this to your attention that this might change, but this is the easiest, quickest way to represent the mechanism, even if you did know what the quote-unquote correct answer was. So I'm going to leave it like this for the moment. What we get initially is a positively charged intermediate. Because both molecules had been neutral, and even though the sulfur is going to lose something in this process, a chlorine, and therefore remain neutral, the oxygen now has three bonds to it. And so it's initially going to be positively charged. Anybody from last quarter or even the new people, do you know what the proper term is for a positively charged oxygen ion is? Oxonium ion. Oxonium ions that have hydrogens are usually very, very acidic, on the level of sulfuric acid acidic. So we'll rapidly have a deprotonation. Now, new students, I'm a little lazy about my hydrogens because, yes, there might be something in solution that's removing this hydrogen, but it doesn't matter what it is. And in the past, when I used to worry more about it, I found that I was always telling people, telling students, don't worry about that, don't worry about that. So at some point, I just decided to stop writing it because it's not important. What's important is the hydrogen comes off. Number one mistake made in O-Chem, though, is writing the arrow towards the hydrogen. Remember that these mechanism arrows show where electrons go, not atoms. So the bond is breaking and leaving its lone pair on oxygen, which gets us a neutral molecule now. But this thing that we just created, this whole thing, turns out to be a really good leaving group. And with the way the reaction is done, that chloride that's still sitting around in solution is able to continue to react and push that off as a leaving group. Part of the reason this does end up being a good leaving group is what happens after it comes off. So I'm not just going to show the SN2 part of it, and this really is an SN2 style mechanism here. Chlorine attacking, simultaneously the oxygen coming off. But instead of it just coming off, that pair of electrons from the carbon-oxygen bond can swing around, attack sulfur. Just as before, causing this wraparound mechanism, during which another chlorine comes off. And so you end up with two products in this case. An alkyl chloride, so that's the point of this reaction. But you also make the byproduct sulfur dioxide. And in mechanisms where we cause the expulsion of either carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, or nitrogen, N2, those are usually thermodynamically very favorable events. We didn't learn anything with N2 last quarter, did we? So we'll see a reaction at some point this quarter or next quarter where we see the expulsion of N2 as a favorable event. Yes? It's formed as a gas, that's right. It bubbles out of the solution. Very stinky, and I think it's a toxic compound as well, so you do have to do this reaction carefully, but very commonly done. Yes? Yes, it does. That's right, because after it comes off, the OSOCl ion continues to decompose.
And then the electron profile goes to the
The electron from the double bond reforms the sulfur oxygen bond and kicks off the chlorine when that happens.
So that's the arrow is coming from the double bond, not from the sulfur.
It's going from the double bond first and then coming from the lone pair on oxygen. Now, why don't we go ahead and write out those six aspects of this reaction so you can make your flashcard. Oh, sorry. Leave that up a little longer. I got all spoiled yesterday because they had the nice modern version of one of these stands where the whole device is maybe only that thick and nothing on the side, so beautiful to write on, having to downgrade coming back here. All right, so synthetic utility. It is to convert an alcohol into an alkyl chloride. What are the reagents used? Principal one is thionyl chloride. Later on, after we're in the quarter a bit, I'm going to put a few more details in this and the next reaction, because there are sometimes some bases that we include to help the reaction along. But a little too much detail just for the first day of the quarter. What conditions must this be done under? We can't have any water, because water has an OH group on it, just like an alcohol does. And so water would just directly react with and decompose the thionyl chloride. Mechanism we have up above. I'm going to skip number 5 for a moment and come to regiochemistry. And essentially, I could say there's none, because it only happens where the functional group happens, and there's not possibilities. It just, wherever the functional group was is where it ends up being. So instead of none, I might say no change. But let's back up now to this last item, the stereochemistry of the overall reaction. Now, look at the reaction mechanism. And tell me, in the first step, does anything happen to the carbon-oxygen bond? First step of the reaction, anything happen to the carbon-oxygen bond? No. So if there was a stereocenter there, nothing would happen to it in the first step. The second step, that's just hydrogen coming off of oxygen. Definitely doesn't have anything to do with the carbon-oxygen bond. What about that last step? It's inversion, because it really is an SN2 reaction. That means that this overall process incurs with inversion, which is really important, because the reason to do this reaction is to make an alcohol into something with a leaving group. If you then did a real SN2 reaction after that, you'd invert the stereochemistry a second time, which would mean overall you'd have an alcohol with a stereocenter that's the same when you get done with your multi-step synthesis. Well, what if you didn't want that? Well, then you got to be aware that this does cause inversion. So just to have written out a specific example, if I take this alcohol that does have a stereocenter, react it with thionyl chloride, I'll get an alkyl halide, but I'll get inversion of configuration. Now, new people, I love deuterium because it's just a form of hydrogen, so that's still technically a primary reaction center. But it's a primary reaction center that's a stereocenter because there is deuterium instead of just hydrogen. So you'll see deuterium in a lot of problems. Yes? It's specific, yes. It stays in the place where the functional group was originally. Now, that's one way of making a leaving group. And again, this one does occur with inversion. But let's say we wanted to convert this into a stereocenter where there wasn't inversion that happened. Well, there's this beautiful little reagent that can do that. Does it kind of look familiar? What's it look kind of like? Looks like a sulfonate, looks like a tosylate. This is what you can create tosylates from. This is para-toluene sulfonyl chloride. For short, it's called tosyl chloride. For really short, the whole thing can be abbreviated as TSCL. So the TOSCL group includes the sulfur, but not what's connected to it. If I'm showing you TOSCL chloride at the same time, I should show you this compound, its smaller cousin. Methane sulfonyl chloride. With the short name mesyl chloride, also abbreviated MSCL. In general, this is a class of compounds known as sulfonyl chlorides. Why am I showing these two in particular? Mesyl chloride is an inexpensive liquid. TOSCL chloride is an inexpensive solid. And so that's why TOSCL chloride is often preferred. It's very easily handleable, reacts really cleanly, smells a little bit like peanuts. Maybe it's from the sulfur, but for a sulfur compound, it's pretty good smelling. So a very easily manipulable compound. What kind of reaction mechanism is there? Well, you might imagine that sulfur is very delta positive, just like the sulfur in thionyl chloride was. And in fact, we're going to see exactly the same style of mechanism. I'll make the same caveat, which is that later we'll learn some additional subtle detail about how the mechanism occurs. This time, to make sure to show the stereochemistry, I'm going to just start with a chiral alcohol. And I'll use TOSCL chloride as my example reagent. So same type of thing happens again that happened with the thionyl chloride. Alcohol can attack the sulfur, causing that sulfur-oxygen bond to open. For the moment, I'm going to say it's fine to show the simultaneous collapse of that bond again, which would cause the chlorine to be kicked off. In that process, notice that the carbon-oxygen bond never gets involved. And so the stereocenter did not change. By the attachment of that sulfonyl group. Just as before, we end up with this fairly acidic oxonium ion, which will then deprotonate. And I'll go ahead and use the abbreviation now that I no longer need to show the structure of tosylate to show that I now end up with that leaving group. Notice that this has retention of configuration. So I'll let you write out your six items for this flashcard on your own, but it's pretty identical to thionyl chloride. Instead of making a chloride, though, we're making a tosylate. Now, I'm sure the question's going to come up right away. Wait a minute. There's a chloride that got kicked off in this process. How come it doesn't come back and attack the tosylate the same way that it did for the thionyl chloride? One answer, a kind of wimpy answer, is, well, the tosylate doesn't decompose as easily as the thionyl chloride. But tosylate's an excellent leaving group. So the other real reason is that mystical other component that I mentioned that's sometimes included in these styles of reaction, a nitrogen-containing base that would remove the hydrogen that falls off in solution. This would be a neutral compound, though, so once it reacts with hydrogen, it forms a positively charged complex with which the chlorine would then become associated with. So because of that, the chlorine is also effectively sort of sopped up and removed from the solution. So these are done under conditions to prevent the chlorine from coming back to attack. For the moment, instead of showing you that base, I would rather just write out the note that due to the inclusion of a base to remove H plus, chloride is effectively prevented from reacting. Okay, and so I was saying, referring to those six items, you're making a tosylate. It also needs to be done in anhydrous conditions. Tosyl chloride's reagent instead of thionyl chloride. It also has no regiochemical effects, meaning the tosylate's going to end up where the alcohol originally was. And the one major difference is this reaction occurs with retention of configuration instead of inversion. Now we have barely enough time for me to squeeze one more reaction in for today. Very simple mechanism involving the compound phosphorus tribromide. This is going to look identical to the reaction of a thionyl chloride. And why would you imagine that this would react that way? Well, phosphorus is under which element on the periodic table? Nitrogen. So this does have a complete octet because there is a lone pair there. But with three bromines on it, it does make the phosphorus fairly positively charged. So an alcohol will react with it in the same way that thionyl chloride would. In this case, though, there's no double bond. And so in the first step, where the alcohol attacks, it's essentially an SN2 style attack where the bromine is just kicked off of the phosphorus. As it has in the previous two reactions, since we started with a neutral alcohol, we're now going to end up with a oxonium ion, which can deprotonate. That group we've just made is, as in the thionyl chloride reaction, a good leaving group. And again, in the same way, the bromide that's still left around in solution is able to come around and attack. So the overall process was to make an alkyl bromide, but with inversion of configuration. Now we have one more of this style reaction that we need to cover on Thursday. I don't think this is in your textbook, but it's a simple reaction. If you want to read up on it before Thursday, it's called the Finkelstein reaction. And it's just an SN2 reaction, but its trick is that it involves a solubility trick. Question. The reagent is PBr3. Oh, but the end there? Yes, it should be only two. Because one came off. There we go. Any last questions? Yes?
The air is going to the oxygen.
The air is going to the oxygen, right. All right, we are out of time for today, so next time we meet will be for Lab Thursday. Bright and early, 7:30.